As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figure that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side, use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie. Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm the other host, Aaron Mate. How are you, Katie?
I'm good, you?
I'm good. You're around the world right now.
I am. I'm traveling. Should I reveal where I am?
Yeah, do it.
Doha for a conference on Palestine.
And how is Doha doing?
Doha seems nice. I really didn't get to see very much of it because I was really involved in this conference.
What was the conference?
It was the Palestine Annual Forum in Doha.
You are there because you were recently censored for speaking out about Palestine by the Hill. So it's great the opportunity to go and speak to other people who I'm sure are censored as well.
Oh, yeah. Lots of people. It was a very very Palestinian in attendance, which was really cool. There were some panels that were only in Arabic, which I wasn't expecting, but which was very cool. And it was cool when there was translation. There wasn't always, but when there was translation, it was great.
All right. Well, as you know, you can go to usefulidiots.substack.com to support us and get bonus content. And among the features you get is access to the Absurd Arena, where you interact with us and other useful idiots and get to ask us questions. So, Wilson, what do we have this week from the Absurd Arena?
So, last week in our excellent interview with Darsha Narvaez, Aaron, you had the quote that Useful Idiots has an audience that really cares about the world and that they're troubled about the state of the world right now. And living in New York City, the problem that I notice the most is the homelessness crisis. And I've noticed that a lot of people who are liberals and progressives speak a lot about fighting poverty and helping the working class, but that it's also pretty much fully acceptable in those same circles to say no to helping the unhoused. And so I asked the Useful Idiots about this, and Aaron, you were definitely right that our audience cares about the world and people gave really great responses. And so I want to ask you two how we can make people understand that this is a human rights emergency and not just another policy to be pushed away.
That's a heavy question, Wilson. Jeez.
Yeah, that's a really heavy question. Yeah. You're saying that you're talking about the fact that people walk by unhoused people on the street without giving them money? Or
yes, and also that in conversations I've had with people who do care about the working class, they also say having homeless people in the city will cause crime or make it dirtier and say push that aside and I think that makes it easier for people to walk by people who are begging for help.
God, that's a heavy question. Aaron, you have any answers for that one?
I think the issue just underscores that it's in everyone's interest to provide everyone with the basics they need to survive, to give everyone access to a home and whatever else they need. Because if you don't, then people will be desperate. And you look at it, it is more difficult now than I remember it before in New York City to take the subway. And I do, in my own experience, see more unhoused people and they have to be taken care of. I mean, and it's in everyone's interest to do that. And, you know, my only other thought that I think might that I have often is like people now, at least like most like people who might be predisposed to give people money, less people carry around cash these days than before because everyone can use their phone and their card. You know, not everyone, obviously, but a lot more people than before are just using their phone or their card to pay for stuff. And I do think there needs to be some kind of thing where you can like Venmo or whatever somebody who's unhoused, because I just know in my own experience, like I never carry around bills anymore. Because I had access to a phone and a card and stuff. And I, I mean, not that this solves the problem, but I do think in terms of like steps, I do think that should be done because I imagine that a lot of unhoused people are getting less money than they would have before the, explosion and people using their phones and their and credit cards.
That's a very funny coincidence. Just yesterday, I started making up a flyer. This guy Paco, who lives near me on the street, I was talking to him about what if I can give you a sign that has a QR code for a Cash App, and then
Wow.
and I so I was wrote on the sign, you say for Paco, and then I would get it to this other account, and then I could bring him the cash each time it gets there.
That would reach more people. It would. And it sucks. I mean, it sucks that we even have to be thinking of ways to give people the basics that they need through like a phone rather than just ensuring a society where everyone doesn't have to beg for food
Yeah.
and money. But that's where we're at.
Yeah, you know what? The other thing I think is hard is that I feel like emotionally, and on a human level, like giving money to people is important. And then at the same time, also, sometimes I feel like, well, this is just one person. Should I give my money to an organization that works on homelessness that will touch lots of people's lives?
Yeah. And I also think that we need to make the connection between spending so much money on the military and
Right.
having cities full of people who are unhoused. And it's not a law of nature that we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on all these weapons and spending all these billions of dollars on a proxy war in Ukraine when that could be spent on repairing our cities at home and making it a better place for everybody. I mean, that connection could be made. It's just not being made politically, but it could be if we wanted to.
Yeah.
But it's a tough question, and of course, there's
And
no
we
need.
just need to be building more housing. I mean, not
That's
even building more. We need to be putting people in housing.
absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
You're right, though. I like what you said that there's no rule of law of nature that says things need to be this way. People could have their basic needs met.
All right, well, speaking of basic, let's get to our four basic food groups. Katie, what do we have
Oh,
this
I like that transition.
week for Democrats Suck?
Okay, so for this week for Democrats Suck, I got Democrats Suck. And this is a story about what's happening in Palestine right now. And just for background, before we get into the actual Democrats sucking, as people hopefully know, Israel killed 10 people, including two children, on Thursday. And then on Friday, a gunman, Palestinian gunman, killed seven people in an illegal settlement. Then over the weekend, settlers attacked Palestinians. They set fire to homes. They harassed a lot of people. They threw stones. At least four Palestinians have been killed since the Jenin attack, which brings the total number of Palestinians killed by Israelis since the start of the year to 35. Eight of them are children. And lovely, lovely news is that one of the things that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did in response to this was expedite gun permits for Israeli citizens. Now, I'm going to go to journalist Sana Saeed, who has a great little video breaking down the differences in the ways that the State Department responded to the killing of Palestinians and the killing of Israelis.
If you've ever wondered how political language is used to dehumanize certain groups of people and humanize other groups of people, here are two really great examples from the same institution and specifically the same person. This is Ned Price. He's a spokesperson for the State Department and specifically for Mr. Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State. Now, here is a tweet that was just published with regards to the shooting that took place in the synagogue earlier today in occupied East Jerusalem. Note how Israelis are humanized. The United States condemns, in the strongest terms, the most horrific terrorist attack today outside of a synagogue in Neve Yaakov, which, by the way, is also a settlement. Our thoughts are with the victims and their families. We reaffirm our unwavering commitment to Israel's security. Israeli humanity and its right to violence is reaffirmed repeatedly, word by word, in this tweet. It's very emotional language. Now look at this tweet from just a day earlier regarding the Jenin refugee camp massacre. where 9 Palestinians, including elderly women, were killed. Not only is the massacre of Palestinians justified as a counterterrorism thing, they're not even mentioned.
Here's what Ned Price had to say when Palestinians were killed. "We are deeply concerned by the escalating violence and loss of innocent life in the West Bank following a counterterrorism operation. We underscore the urgent need to prevent further loss of civilian life and to de-escalate tensions." So one is described as a counterterrorism operation, and the other one is described as a terrorist attack, which obviously shows just a major double standard. I mean, to be fair, in some ways, one is just state-sanctioned terrorism, and the other one doesn't have state sanctioning. But you just see a typical double standard that we see from the Biden administration when it comes to Palestinian versus Israeli humanity.
Yeah, the fundamental reality of this whole situation, which is that there's a occupation going on. It's been going on for decades. Israel's only deepened it throughout the years of the so-called peace process. That is not acknowledged. And there's a certain, it's actually not only is there a parity given to two sides that aren't equal, because there's an occupied and an occupier, and those sides are not equal. But the occupied, when they resist, it's their actions that get condemned. And when it's the occupier doing the violence, which is the infinitely worse violence, that gets defended or watered down in its criticism. And that's where Democrats are no different than Republicans. Nancy Pelosi once said, or I think Biden said this too, that if Israel wasn't founded, we'd have to create it ourselves.
Biden said that. He also said that he's a Zionist. But yeah, it's just like in one case, you know, they're so reluctant to call Palestinians victims. I think maybe because if they did, they'd have to acknowledge that they're constantly victims just because of the structural realities on the ground. Yeah. But it's telling that he says our thoughts are with the victims and their families when it's Israeli victims. And when it's Palestinian victims, it's just the loss of innocent life.
Yeah,
it's kind of abstract. There are no people there. It's just an abstract thing, like the loss of life. Yeah, that sucks. But it's not a very emotional thing the way that individual victims are.
Absolutely.
And he also makes it seem like by calling it a counterterrorism operation, it's an inevitability, or it's collateral damage for something that had to happen. So a lot of whitewashing, sanitizing, double standards, none of which is surprising.
And this is what you called out in your monologue for The Hill that got censored, right? That's the kind of dynamic you were speaking about, right?
Yeah, the fact that there's an apartheid state there and people pretend that it's not that. People pretend it's normal and that Israel is just pursuing security. And of course, they're pursuing security. When you're an occupying power and you're pursuing security, you're actually terrorizing people. And as you said, there's no parity. And anyone who says both sides, anyone who talks about clashes, anyone who talks about violence in general, as if there's some kind of level playing field, is actually engaged in propaganda.
Both sides is the wrong side.
Yeah, both sides is the wrong side. And that doesn't mean that we are dismissive of human life if it's on one side versus the other. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about why one side is constantly living under the boot of the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, it's interesting that the shooter, the Palestinian, his grandfather was killed by a settler.
Not surprising at all.
All right.
So for Republican talk, let's go to Senator Marco Rubio of Florida.
President Biden is reportedly close to issuing an executive order when it comes to restrictions on U.S. investments in China. But there's concern about risking further escalation. What's your view on how far that action should go?
The Chinese have found a way to use capitalism against us. And what I mean by that is the ability to attract investment into entities that are deeply linked to the state. That military commercial fusion that exists in China is a concept that we don't have in this country. We have contractors that do defense work, but there is no distinction in China between advancements in technology, biomedicine, whatever it might be, and the interests of the state.
So I love that. I love the idea that like someone else is using capitalism against us when capitalism is just supposed to be about open market and, you know, the best capitalist wins. But even funnier is when he complains that China has this horrible dynamic where the state and capital are intertwined. Unlike us, we don't have that at all. So our military is completely separate from the private sector. Even though, I mean, just looking at personnel, like right now, our Pentagon Secretary, Lloyd Austin, what is he? A former Raytheon executive. And you can go down the list, and there's, of course, a revolving door between industry and government in the U.S.
Right.
Marco Rubio wants to pretend as if that's just a Chinese issue.
What's it called? The Chinese wall? Yeah, Chinese wall. It's a Chinese wall or ethical wall. It's an information barrier protocol within an organization designed to prevent exchange of information or communication that could lead to conflicts of interest. Just ironic.
Yeah, so Marco Rubio is basically pretending as if this wall exists in the U.S.
Right.
China, and that's why China's using capitalism against us. Well, he should take a look at the balance sheet of the military-industrial complex, which is raking in billions of dollars and has plenty of people who have cycled in and out of government, because that's how it works in the U.S. as well.
Do you think he just expects people not to actually pay attention to what he's saying?
I don't think he even thinks about that, because he knows that no one's going to challenge him. Like, no journalist is going to challenge him for speaking that way about an official enemy. So he can say whatever he wants. And speaking of firewalls, I mean, like, that whole bubble is completely walled off from any type of criticism or critical thinking. So yeah, he can say whatever he wants.
So disturbing.
All right. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
Okay, so for Isn't That Weird, we have a very weird story. This is out of Virginia, and let's just play the videotape.
All right, file this one under one of the strangest stories I've ever heard of and talked about. Last Friday, we received an email from the mother of a player on the Churchland High School girls JV basketball team that an assistant coach on the team named Arlisha Boykins impersonated a 13-year-old player on the team that was out of town for a club basketball tournament. Here's video from that game. Churchland is in the black uniforms. Number one right there that just came up with the black block shot. We're told that is Arlisha Boykins. They were taken on Nansman River. This video has been edited to show you some of the highlights. Arlisha is apparently a 22-year-old young woman going up against 14 and 15-year-old girls. Now, we have confirmed that Boykins is no longer an employee of Portsmouth Public Schools. And since this game, the student athletes on the team and parents decided to just end the season. They will not be playing any more games this year. Portsmouth Public Schools did launch an investigation into this matter. The details have not been revealed by officials quite yet. Now, I spoke with the father of the 13-year-old girl that was being impersonated. Here's what he had to say about his reaction when he heard the news.
Coaches, you know, always preach to the kids, you know, about integrity and those type of things. So I was just shocked. I just need, you know, an apology, you know, because I haven't yet received one from, you know, the overseer of the program or nothing. You know, he just came out and just told us the stipulations of what was going to happen, but there was no apology issue personally to us, even in his presence.
We're going to follow up with this story if more information comes out. Those parents told me today that they are simply just seeking an apology from Churchland school officials.
This is very upsetting to the girl who was impersonated, and she's decided she doesn't want to go back to that school.
Wow, she's quitting school.
Well, that school at least.
Yeah.
I hope she's not dropping education altogether, but that must have been a weird thing for these kids to experience. Their coach coming out pretending to be one of them.
I mean, so my problem is I very much relate to that coach, because, you know, I play basketball. It's my favorite sport. I played it for a long time and I love the game. And I can imagine being out there and you see this opportunity to play and, you know, you want to maybe redeem yourself for your own high school experience where you maybe didn't play as well as you wanted to. So this is your opportunity and you get to go out there and you know, show people what you got. So I very much relate.
So for Aaron, this isn't that relatable.
It's
not isn't that weird, but isn't that relatable? Isn't that inspiring? At first, I thought it was like a scary story where the woman like kidnapped the person, like she said impersonator to her. I thought she had like tied her up and put her in a closet or something. I didn't realize she just took advantage of her absence. But
if you love the game, you're willing to go to great lengths for the game.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a step too far, but again, relatable. Oh, I have to.
She should have not scored so much, though. That was she got cocky.
She got
a little too cocky. Yeah, maybe she could have gotten away with it if she hadn't dominated to such an extent.
Yeah.
But I don't know what she thought would happen. Like, no one would notice.
Yeah, I guess she thought she could get away with it. But she got caught, and we have the footage. I mean, there's something. I'm sure it was a really tough experience for the young people involved. But there's something really fun too.
I know there is. Yeah.
All right. For Isn't That Terrible? Check out this video. This was tweeted out by Russell Brand, and check out what he found. So for people who are just listening to this podcast, that's a video of a bunch of robotic dogs, I guess, or some kind of animal doing push-ups.
Yeah, dogs, yeah.
Yeah. And Russell Brand tweeted this out and asked, what are they preparing for? That's a great question. What are they preparing for? And whenever I see these things, it's very jarring. Like, do we need to have room full of robotic dogs, you know, preparing for what looks like some sort of physical challenge or even battle? It just looks like they're coming to get us.
Well, I think they're trying to use those for policing.
Oh, okay.
Which is really scary.
Yeah. I mean, with all that's going on in the world, do we need to introduce the robot dogs right now? I'm not so sure. No. Yeah. I think we have enough scary things going on. But
it's going to happen, though. They're going to definitely do it.
Yeah.
It's like straight out of RoboCop.
Yes. Robo-dogs.
Robo-dogs, yeah.
All right. Well, this week we have a great interview. The one and only Matt Taibbi, the co-founder of the show, will be joining us to discuss the latest in the Twitter files.
Well, we are so excited whenever we have the chance to bring back into the fold, onto the motherboard. I don't even know if that works. Onto the mothership. Journalist Matt Taibbi.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Did we have like a sign-on tag? I can't remember. Like, did we have like a shtick at the beginning?
I don't know. Did we? It's
been like 5 million.
Welcome to Useful Idiots. Hi, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm your host, Katie Hopper, and this is my co-host, or this is the other host. I think I'd say that a lot. This is the other host. Yeah. People like our awkward openings, but Aaron does not like it. Aaron likes a very scripted opening.
So
he's probably squirming.
You know, he has the whole Democracy Now. He wants it to flow like
right.
You know, like a real news program.
He wants us to talk about
right. Talk about banks.
Yeah.
But no, people. I think with you and me, Katie. I think people really like the awkward energy.
Exactly.
The two of us, right? Like we were always sort of on many levels. So
yeah. people are going to be so thrilled. All right, and that's a wrap. Thanks so much for coming. It's been great. Yeah. We've invited you on because we thought it would be a good time to have on a Russian troll. And you're obviously one of those. But in all seriousness, please do tell us about your latest revelation, your latest Twitter files drop.
So the latest one I did, Katie, was about this. I think we must have talked about this group on the show, Hamilton 68.
I think so, yeah.
Because at the time, actually, I guess we started the show after this, right? This was basically a think tank that was had some mysterious origins, which I'm hoping to get into a little bit next week. But it was one of the first sort of confluences of Bush Republicanism and Clintonian Democrats. It was a think tank that it's like multiple layers of them. There's the German Marshall Fund, then there's this thing called the Alliance for Securing Democracy, which was created by a sort of blue-red pair. There's Jamie Fly, who was a longtime Marco Rubio sort of right-hand man. And then Laura Rosenberger, who was the senior foreign policy advisor for Hillary for America. And they had this kind of, you know, you got your chocolate and my peanut butter thing, where they sort of banded together against Trump and the Russian invasion and all that, and created this thing called the Hamilton 68 dashboard, which was designed to track, quote unquote, Russian disinformation and Russian influence activities. Just randomly going through some Twitter email looking for something completely different, I've sort of found this lengthy exchange between the senior Twitter executives basically saying that this whole thing was a fraud and that there's nothing to it, and that the Hamilton 68 dashboard, which is based on 600 accounts that they said were linked to Russia, and that if they outed, Russia would shut down. It turns out to be mostly Americans, Westerners, Canadians, British, etc., real accounts of real people with very limited followings. And then like RT and Sputnik, the whole thing was a sham. So it was like a factory producer of wrong news stories. And the amazing thing about it is that you have these quotes in the emails from people like Yoel Roth saying, "We need to call this out for the bullshit it is." I mean, you never get
something. Yoel Roth from Twitter.
Yeah, from Twitter, exactly. It's just, if you work in journalism for decades, you might get something this satisfying like 10 times. I don't know, maybe. But I think this is a real thing. And then I think now it seems like it might be leading to some other places too, which is cool.
And you saw when people were saying, when Yoel Roth was saying, "We need to call this out as bullshit," he got pushback from other people at Twitter who were saying, "Actually, we can't push back too much." Why were they afraid to push back too much?
So yeah, I sped over this, but the Alliance for Securing Democracy is a very powerful connected organization. If you look at their advisory council, it's like an amazing rogues gallery of intelligence creatures. It's got the former DHS chief, Mike Chertoff, former acting CIA head, Michael Morell, who was gonna be Hillary's CIA chief. And then there's a former deputy NSA chief in there. There's some other folks. There's Bill Kristol. There's John Podesta. So this is an outfit that's very connected to the political establishment and the intelligence community. And they were afraid of making enemies of this group, which was very also connected to Congress and particularly the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And they didn't want to go to war with them publicly. So you see all these emails where, you know, once in a future White House spokesperson, Emily Horn, who's working at Twitter at the time, is saying things like, "We need to proceed carefully with ASD." So it's basically that, you know, they know it's a sham, but they're afraid to say it publicly.
I was going to ask you to share some of the people who they named, who they've discovered on this list that they wouldn't publish.
Oh God, the Hamilton 68 list of people. So
who stands out?
Well, there's only a couple of names that would really jump out at you because you'd recognize them. Most of the accounts, I think the thing that's really interesting about it is that most of them have almost no engagement. So there's actually a tweet in there where the head of policy, Nick Pickles, is saying, he's got a
name. Nick
But he's saying, we can't call people who have 5, 8, 12 accounts a massive influence operation, right? But there are a few in there, like the editor-in-chief of Consortium, Joe Loria.
Right.
There's a kind of former Newsmax/Fox guy named Dennis Michael Lynch who's on there. David Horowitz, the writer, is on there, of all people. But
the neocon writer,
exactly.
That's so weird.
Lefty, right, whatever. And then there's a series. There are a few accounts that were like followed maybe by the World Socialist website. Like there's a sort of an overtly parodic Stalinist account that's in there, but it's got like 8 followers or something like that. And then there's a ton of these sort of small organic Trump accounts with names like, you know, at Trump Dyke, believe it or not, or Classy Lady for DJT. There's lots of those, and I contacted a bunch of those folks, and they are what they profess to be. I talked to a 73-year-old grandmother in Florida who's, I think she calls herself Ultra MAGA Dog Mom or something like that. So these are real people. And they're from all over the world, but mostly America. It's just very striking that that they would end up on a list like this. There's also a lot of sort of smaller, like very small media operations on there, like the Sirius Report. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but if you look it up on Twitter, you'll find there's a bunch of things like that that might be like retweeting RT, but they're real, you know. So that's what's on the list.
And that Lebanese woman.
Yeah, there's a woman I talked to named Sonia Mansour, who grew up in Lebanon. She told a story about as a girl, her village was attacked by, I guess there was
Christian militias, right?
Militia, yeah, and her father, they were trying to get out of the house, and her father was sort of advising her to get rid of all of their sort of pro-leftist books. Because they were afraid of having their political beliefs known, and especially her being a woman, they were afraid of like things that would happen to her, and they fled the country, and she ended up actually in Canada. And she was telling me the story, and she basically saying that this is the first thing I thought of when I heard I was on this crazy digital blacklist, is after all that, you know, to come to a free country and have that happen to you is just completely crazy.
Well, let's go to some of the ways in which all of this was portrayed to the public, because it's easy to look back on it now and just look at this as a joke. But at the time, the way Hamilton 68 and the Alliance for Security and Democracy were presented is that they were these, you know, intrepid people trying to protect the country from the influence of Russian bots. And they were often cited in the media and taken very seriously. So this is a clip put out by your site, Matt Racket, just showing how all these various think tanks in Washington promoted Hamilton 68.
We work with the Hamilton 68 Project to really understand the foreign influence online.
Hamilton 68 falsely accused legitimate American accounts of being Russian bots.
Hamilton 68, we track Russian bot armies.
Hamilton 68 are tracking this the most.
Hamilton 68, I'll tell you what the Russian associated accounts were doing.
Hamilton 68.
Hamilton 68.
Hamilton 68.
Hamilton 68 looks at Russian accounts.
Wonderful website called Hamilton 68 that tracks known Russian bots.
Look at Hamilton 68. I encourage you to look at that.
The Hamilton 68 Reset.
Really interesting website students will really enjoy.
Hamilton 68 has just been such an amazing resource.
Hamilton 68 knows they're Russian bots.
Hamilton 68 dashboard, if you want to track their covert accounts.
We need more fact-checking like Hamilton 68.
Hamilton 68.
Hamilton 68.
They track Russian-associated troll farms.
There is no evidence to support their statements.
Hamilton 68.
That's bull.
Did you note the one that really stood out to me was Michael Hayden, the former head of the CIA, talking about how Hamilton 68 is, you know, really tracking those Russian accounts? What do you think the percentage chances that Michael Hayden doesn't know exactly what's on that list? Mm-hmm. I mean, again,
it's like dumb or disingenuous. Which right, one exactly. is it?
Yeah, no, and Aaron, I think you were right to talk about how. I mean, I apologize actually for smiling about this, because at the time it was not a joke. It's not a joke now. Like, this is still going on. They were very successful in whipping up this hysteria. This technique really birthed a new kind of news story, which was, you know, Russians are interested in this, and we know that because of digital evidence. Why, right? And it's not just Hamilton 68 that did this. There is a whole range of research institutions that are now dedicated to this kind of thing. But this was really the progenitor of all those news stories. And as you know, you can see, it's not just the think tanks. It was really every major news organization. Aaron, I mean, you wrote about this. You talked about this at the time, right? It was the New York Times, CNN, CBS, ABC, MSNBC did obviously countless segments on this, because Watts, Clint Watts, the front man for this, is a paid analyst for them. So it had incredible penetration across a very wide variety of subjects, from Trump to the Parkland shooting to the release the memo campaign, to all kinds of other things.
Well, let's go to a few examples of that, and we could have picked many, but we're just going to take a couple from MSNBC. First, this is from Morning Joe in February 2018, right after the Parkland school shooting.
Kremlin-linked accounts flooded Twitter,
using hashtags like Parkland and Gun Control Now to get into trending conversations. According to data collected by the nonpartisan dashboard Hamilton 68, the trolls then added more incendiary hashtags and explosive imagery to drive their readers to more partisan conversations.
Yeah, none of this is normal. Also, we keep talking about how the Russians tried to interfere in our last election. Well, they're interfering, and the interference continues. Not only did they interfere in the last election, when we had Devin Nunes trying to release a memo to undermine an investigation into Russia, they were extraordinarily active. The Russians, their secret service, their bots, flooding with hashtags, release the memo, to try to interfere in an American debate, to try to derail a Russian investigation. And then we saw again yesterday, once again, the Russian bots, and obviously connected with Russian intel agencies, getting involved in a school shooting to try to stir up unrest and undermine our democracy.
So we should just explain what he's talking about there. So he talks about this alleged Russian bot effort to spread this hashtag, release the memo, to promote a memo written by Devin Nunes, who was then a member of Congress on the House Intelligence Committee. And what Nunes found was that the FBI had relied on the Steele dossier for surveillance applications on Carter Page and then lied about it and concealed the fact that they had no corroboration for Steele's claims and that the Steele dossier was being paid for by the Clinton campaign. They concealed that from the FISA court. So Devin Nunes, when he saw that information, wrote a memo documenting that and wanted to put it out. And people who wanted to discredit Nunes's memo came up with this idea that actually Russian bots were promoting this hashtag on Twitter. So that's what Morning Joe is promoting there, along with this claim that Russian bots were taking advantage of the Parkland shooting to sow chaos in the U.S.
Yeah, there's two things about that I think are striking. One is that part of Nunes's memo, remember the irony here, is that he was outing a fake news operation.
That's right.
The Steele dossier was essentially funneled to Michael Isikoff, who, again, we have to give credit to for being basically the only RussiaGate reporter to ever answer questions about this. But he wrote the first story for Yahoo, this reporter, Michael Isikoff, about the Steele stuff, which was sort of fed to him. And then the Clinton campaign tweeted out the Isikoff story that they themselves had planted, essentially, right? And then funneled through various organizations. So that's like a fake news operation. It was sort of novel, actually, the way they did it. Nunes outs it in the memo. And then when people are calling for this to be publicized, it's denounced as fake Russian news, which I guess we should be surprised at, but we're not, obviously, right? We're used to this by now. The other thing I should point out is that this stuff does happen, right? There are influence operations. All countries do this. We do this. The Russians do have stuff like this. And ironically, what I'm learning is that the Russian version is based on ours. But what's interesting about that is that the Hamilton 68 is exactly where it wasn't happening, right? Like the accounts that they were tracking, there may be a few Russian bots in there, but mostly it's real people who are reacting to real news stories. And so what they were doing mostly was describing organic conversations of people talking about, for instance, the Parkland shooting, and just calling it, you know, Russian disinformation. And I think that's an important distinction for people to understand.
And let's go to one more example. This is Ari Melber of MSNBC in January 2018.
Russia's meddling effort is continuing this week, including a propaganda campaign designed to infiltrate online debate here in the U.S. New data showing that Russia-linked bots are hyping terms like Schumer shutdown and pushing a Republican campaign criticizing the Russia probe, lending fake support to this effort called hashtag release the memo. Now, that is big news. Now, while Donald Trump weirdly denies his own intelligence agency's findings that Russia meddled over a year ago, this is a report that they're meddling this week. Is anyone going to do anything? Well, top Democrats sounding the alarm and taking the fight to Facebook and Twitter. Dianne Feinstein writing to Mark Zuckerberg and the current Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, saying this meddling is designed to, quote, undermine Special Counsel Mueller's investigation. Now, the man who used to have Dorsey's job is Dick Costolo. He was at the helm when the company successfully went public. And back before the 2016 controversies, he was warning employees about the need for Twitter to strengthen responses to abuse on their platforms. The former Twitter CEO is my special guest. He is a co-founder and CEO right now of the fitness startup Chorus. Thank you for doing this interview.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's fun.
Let's get to Chorus and health, but start with Twitter, which you know best. Why does it still have a bot problem? And does Russia's ability to use this platform so well concern you?
So again, Matt, going back to your point, in the name of combating a supposed disinformation campaign, they're running a disinformation campaign, and you see the feedback loop. So Alliance for Security and Democracy and Hamilton 68 put out these claims, and they get parroted and widely disseminated by the U.S. media, and no one is told the truth, which they're concealing, that their own lists show no evidence at all that any other claims are real, and that basically this is a scam.
Yeah, and I think that one was referencing Schumer's shutdown.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are actually a number of emails in there. I published one of them, I think, that specifically has Yul Roth talking about how there's absolutely nothing, you know, connecting to Schumer's shutdown to Russia. There's one saying, I'll do another sweep for spam shortly, but as of yesterday, this looked like the right-leaning hashtag about the shutdown, which only got the label of Russian because the Hamilton dashboard falsely accuses a bunch of legitimate right-leaning accounts of being Russian bots. Yeah, again, the mechanism is so primitive, and I think what's kind of shocking to me, and you both have to, I think you would both agree that as a reporter, if somebody brings this to you and says this is Russian disinformation, you're going to at least ask a couple of questions, like, how? What's your methodology? Like, I mean, are you going to attach your name to that if you don't understand it fully? That's what perplexes me about the whole thing. I'm curious what you think about that.
I mean, these are not people, I think, interested in educating the public. They're interested in running propaganda, and their goals, I think, are now pretty well known. They didn't like Trump because Trump put an ugly face on the U.S. war machine. They wanted somebody more polished who could, for example, not blurt out the truth that we're in Syria to steal oil. And also, they didn't like that he was calling for cooperation with Russia, which they also didn't appreciate. And these are neocons, and they see Russia as a inherent enemy, and they want to do whatever they can to encourage fear of Russia. And this is a part of that. Like, when you so panic about an invasion of Russian bots brainwashing us, you encourage this belief that Russia is this mortal enemy that needs to be defeated and we can't do diplomacy with. And so I think all this just played into that agenda.
Yeah, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but okay. Like, I can see that with Clint Watts. I can see that with some of these people, but Ari's not, I mean, he's not stupid, right? Like, why is there not one person at any one of these organizations who stood up and said, I mean, I guess there was BuzzFeed. They did a story about this, but.
Did BuzzFeed criticize it, or do they promote
it? Okay.
Yeah, they criticized. Yeah, you talked about that, Matt.
Miriam Elder.
They called it. They cursed it. Didn't they say bullshit or something? They used some.
This is not to mince words. Bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look. So in terms of media culture, I think there were just massive incentives to go along with this, and the repercussions were if you dissented, you were accused of being a Russian agent and called names, and you weren't hired for jobs. And so, you know, it created a culture where people were just incentivized to drink the Kool-Aid.
I think some people actually like lose track of where they're getting their information from and hear it's perpetuated so many times that they actually just think it's true. And then there, I think some people who, yeah, I mean, this is always a fascinating question. It's hard to really get to the answer about people's inner psychology. But I do think some people really believe it. Some people are convincing themselves. Some people think that they're like cutting corners, but they're doing it in order to save democracy.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe it's because I'm like from an older era, right? And the incentive structure then was very strongly weighted toward if you make a factual error, it is career ending, right? If you sign your name to something totally bogus, your life is over. You won't work again. Right. And the the stories out there of, you know, whether it was the editor who approved the infamous story in the Washington Post, the fake story about the homeless kid in the 80s. Remember that whole phenomenon? There's a whole series of these, like, where the editors get beat on a story and they're forced out of their jobs and they never work again, or the reporter gets beat on something like the UVA rape story and it's very difficult to keep working, right? So you have this built-in fear of signing your name to anything that's fake that was always, I think, previously at the forefront of most journalists' belief systems. So that's what I don't get about some of these, for instance, MSNBC broadcasters. I can see silently not saying anything, but it's something else entirely to put your name on it. You know, that's the part I don't get.
Maybe they just thought the truth would never come out.
I guess, but maybe. I just wonder about, you know.
Matt, either you have integrity or you don't. I think this is what it comes down to. And if you don't have integrity, then you're going to overlook your own critical faculties to be able to keep your status. And, you know, if you have a show on MSNBC, you're rewarded with a lot of money and some attention and a studio. It's nice to go into a studio, you know.
It is.
You know, instead of doing this from your apartment, you know.
Yeah.
That factors in. Not everyone can stomach, you know, doing a podcast from their apartment. So, you know,
our home.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is for them is there are no consequences, as you say, right? No one gets fired for parroting propaganda campaigns like Russiagate and this iteration, the Hamilton 68 dashboard. In fact, you get rewarded. So, you know, it comes down to, can you look yourself in the mirror? And some people can. And I'm sure they point to all the benefits they get from going along with this as justification.
Well, this might be a good moment to point out the story by Jeff Gerth this week.
Yes, yes.
In the Columbia Journalism.
Oh, yeah.
It's a unique thing in the history of journalism, right? So Jeff Gerth is a longtime New York Times sort of frontline reporter who covered all like the biggest stories in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, covered the Clinton White House, did all this stuff. As credentialed as a reporter gets, drops a 20,000 word story in the Columbia Journalism Review, fights for it for years, works on it for years. And it's that book length treatment is just a catalog of errors, and it's full of on the record comments by people like Bob Woodward, who talks about going into the New York Post newsroom, the Washington Post newsroom, and warning people away from the Steele dossier stories and having everybody just tune them out. There's one thing like that after the other, and the entire business is freezing him out. As we record this, it's like 2 days afterward. And has anybody picked it up? Nobody in media has picked up, has done a 30-second segment about 20,000 words in the Columbia Journalism Review, which just, I mean, it's incredible.
It's an amazing story, and it's devastating. You can tell that a lot of work went into the story because Jeff Gerth goes into so many of the different iterations of Russiagate and shows how the media parroted unsupported claims. And then whenever evidence came out that undermined the innuendo that they supported about a Trump-Russia conspiracy and that Mueller was closing in on it, they just ignored it. They did not print the facts that undermined all the conspiracy theories that they were promoting. And you see a refusal to reckon with what they did. So Jeff Gerth contacted dozens of journalists and editors, and he says that he heard back from about half of them. And a lot of people, prominent journalists, refused to comment on the record about stories that they put out, you know, stories promoting Christopher Steele, the author of the Steele dossier, or stories like in the New York Times, which said that the U.S. government had intercepted communications between Trump campaign aides and senior Russian intelligence officials. All these explosive and really consequential stories, now the same people who wrote them refuse to own up to them. And it's an amazing episode. And you can't get more mainstream than the Columbia Journalism Review. So it's not as if you can just dismiss this as like fringe journalists, you know, people who are on Substack or whatever else, people on the left. This is the most mainstream journalism publication there is. And the wall of silence is it's amazing. It's very, it speaks volumes.
And just quickly to give a shout out to Jeff on this, like the contrast is incredible, because you think about, like, for instance, the Hamilton 68 stories. This is what they're taking advantage of is a new phenomenon in journalism where you're just lazy, right? Like, you know, you see these stories like Kevin Drum does a thing in Mother Jones. Oh, here's what Russian bots are tweeting about today, right? So he just goes over to the site, looks at it for 10 seconds, then starts writing, right? But Jeff Gerth is, he comes from this other tradition, which, I mean, obviously we've had flashy reporters in our day, but Gerth is like a worker. You know, he's one of these people who will hound somebody day after day and to try to move stories incrementally from off the record to on the record, right? To try to get some, you know, instead of having two stories, having two sources, to have three sources or four sources. This story is full of incredible, like, achievements on that score, right? It's got the on record commentary from people in the FBI who were in the middle of this stuff, and it's a testament to what the job is, right? And for it to be completely ignored by everybody in the profession is just such an insult. It's astonishing to me.
And there's something cool to me about Jeff being someone, he's in his late 70s, I believe. And he was at the Times from 1976 until the mid 2000s. And there's something cool to me about this old school journalist, a veteran, you know, highly decorated, you know, who was there at the Times in an era when I think it was doing more adversarial journalism, at least more certainly than it is now. Sort of coming back during retirement to call out a new generation that became very partisan, especially around Russiagate, totally ignored the facts in front of them to push a narrative that they knew was unsupported. And I just think, I mean, the fact that this comes from someone who's from an era of journalism that I think is no more, but that I think we have a lot to learn from, it's very valuable. And he didn't have to do this. He could have stayed in retirement. But I think it, and you get the impression, he writes a note at the end of the piece about, you know, his own personal reflections on this reporting he did. Which he's never done. Yeah. That this was very important to him because, there's a craft to journalism that he's trying to protect, which he feels was undermined by Russiagate.
Yeah. I think you can read it almost like this is somebody who I think the profession meant a lot to him. I mean, he had dedicated his life to it. I mean, again, it's mostly a thankless job. If you did it the way people used to do it in newspapers, it's not glamorous. There's a lot of stuff that goes on during the day before you sit down to write that is just, you know, it's very thankless. But at the end of the day, you want to think that you're doing something that's important, right? And I think if you spend decades, as he did, working in this job and spending so much effort, and then have it all come crashing down in this one stupid story that everybody piles onto, I think he wanted to try to restore some credibility and you sort of issue a clarion call to the business to wake up before it's too late, kind of thing. And you can see where that would be coming from, right? From his perspective. And again, I hope there's somebody like a Jake Tapper out there is listening to this who feels like moved.
He's a big fan of the show.
Well, I mean, there are people, they listen. I think they do. And I think that they will hear stuff like this. If they want to listen to us, you know, do it for this guy. Like this guy paid his dues.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. And we'll link to this story. It's very long, so you'll need a lot of time to read it. It's over 20,000 words. But if you care about the state of the U.S. media and you care about the damage that Russiagate did to the media and I think to the world, then you'll want to read the story because it's comprehensive and very devastating.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
Great to hear from Matt. Like I said, what a public service he's doing in exposing all of these Russiagate frauds. And I very much look forward to what he has next.
He teased it. You heard it here first, guys. He teased it here first, which is yet another reason you should become Substack supporters, because you'll hear an exclusive tease that he does on this show. He doesn't do it anywhere else. and he gives us a hint about what's coming next, and it's going to be good.
And that's right. Go to usefulidiots.substack.com to subscribe for bonus content. Also find us on Locals, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone. Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.